Hello, and welcome to Freudian Quips, a WPRK 91.5 FM radio show dedicated to promoting mental health awareness through the examination of popular culture and global current events. I'm your co-host, Dr. Samuel Sanabria, and unfortunately, Dr. Derek Palladino is unable to join us today. But we do have a very special guest with us today. Her name is Faith Neese, and she is an associate sex addiction therapist here in Orlando, Florida. And today we're going to talk about sex and love addiction. But before we have her introduce herself, I'd like to share a little bit of statistics that I have found that's interesting regarding sexual addiction and pornography viewing. According to the National Council on Sexual Addiction Compulsivity, it is estimated that 6 to 8% of Americans are sex addicts, which comes to about 18 to 24 million people. 42% of internet users view pornography. More than 80% of women who have porn addiction take it offline, which is far more than men. Which is very interesting. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. So, celebrity-wise, because I know that this has been on the news a lot recently, but we have quite a few celebrities who have come out as being sex addicts. The most recent one being Charlie Sheen, who came out as being HIV positive, but in that, he also admitted to having a sex addiction and problems with intimacy. Tiger Woods has been another one. Jesse James has also come out. Michael Douglas was one of the first celebrities to come out with having or struggling with sex addiction. I have not come across anything regarding Brad Pitt, but that's good to know. And on the female celebrity side, there's not a lot of female celebrities who have come out being sex addicts. Now, there has been talk about Lindsay Lohan being a sex addict, but a lot of the other celebrities who have come out, you know, talk more a line of, you know, having a relationship or love addiction. So I guess we'll talk a little bit more about that as we learn about sex addiction. So welcome, Faith Neese, to Freudian Quips. This is your first time on the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you on here. So you're an associate sex addictions therapist here. Can you say a little bit more about what is that?
Yeah, so I am certified through an organization called ITAP, which is the International Institute of Trauma and Addictions Professionals. And a licensed CSAT therapist, which is a certified sex addiction therapist, is a specialty certification that you can get post-licensure. It's a 4-module course, about 120 hours, as well as supervision. That is a postgraduate degree. And then I've been in practice with New Leaf Center here in Winter Park, Florida for about 3 years. And our practice specializes in treating sex addiction. And I am accompanied by 3 other certified sex addiction therapists on staff. So that has been a really enriching experience.
How many did you say?
3 others.
3 others. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so they all work with sex addiction.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you said that this is a additional education that you received
postgraduate.
Okay. So what is your degree in?
My degree is in mental health counseling from here at Rollins, actually.
Oh, yeah. Hey. Yeah.
And I am a registered mental health counseling intern as well as a registered marriage and family therapist intern.
Wow. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Well, so happy to have you on the show. Okay. So let's go ahead and start. And the first question that I have for you is, what is sex addiction?
Yeah. So it's interesting because there's kind of that idea that sex addiction and sexuality and all that stuff is that it might not be a real thing. But sex addiction is different in the fact that it is a progressive disorder in which a person has compulsive thoughts or behaviors around their sexuality. And it can be different from person to person. So sex addiction might look different in one client versus another client because it is so highly individualized. So this part of the struggle is like, if you have someone who's alcoholic, it's pretty across the board what alcoholism is. With sex addiction, it's very personal and kind of internal, and we don't talk as much about, you know, here's the sexual behaviors I'm engaging in versus here's how many nights a week I'm going out drinking. So sex addiction can be a little bit harder to identify because of that quiet or shame, silence about sex. But sex addiction it's a pattern of behaviors, thoughts, or feelings that then lead to consequences and relational issues.
Yeah, I can imagine it's very difficult to define what sex addiction is, because we're just looking at a behavior that is innate in us. You know, as human beings, we do connect with others socially, and that's what we were made to do. And part of that is that physical intimacy, that sexual relationship. Some people just have very high sex drives and they enjoy having sex and they can have it multiple times. And so where do you draw the line as far as what is sex addiction?
Yeah.
How much is too much?
Yes, exactly. So the difference between what is acceptable sexual behavior and someone who might have sex addiction is there starts to become like a loss of control. I no longer can control, or I'm not in charge of my sexual behaviors. So with that, it becomes, I start to think about it so much that I'm not thinking about my responsibilities at work. My work life might start to suffer. My relationships might suffer. So I have this preoccupation. I have loss of control. I can start to damage my relationship with myself, my relationship with others. And also I start to, in sex addiction, that's different than just a high sex drive, is that there is a lack of intimacy in their romantic relationships. So the normal person who might just have a high sex drive would still want to engage in an intimate emotional relationship with their partner or other people. And when we see sex addiction, usually that's from an intimacy disorder, from this more of a place of not knowing how to relate other than using sex in order to get connection. We also look at, with sex addiction, the increased risk, high-risk behaviors. You know, so there starts to become more and more high-risk behaviors in order to achieve the same results. So with any kind of addiction, that's what makes the difference between a normal behavior and an addiction, is I start to increase the amount of time, the amount of thought, the amount of money spent on that particular thing. Mm-hmm. So that progressive nature.
So with substance addiction, what you just mentioned right there would be tolerance.
Yes.
That your body naturally develops a tolerance for the substance that you're abusing.
Yes.
So that it requires more and more, right?
Yes.
Is that what you were talking
about? Exactly.
But it's a physiological experience as well as psychological, and I do understand that. But there is that physiological, that the body does require that more and more. Is it the same thing with sex, or is it just psychological?
New research. So we're in a really neat time with brain research, and new research is showing that there starts to become a tolerance to the dopamine that is released during sexual activity, especially during orgasm. So there's new evidence to support that there is likely a connection between that physiological, I need more of that dopamine, I need more of that chemical release, and so I do have a higher tolerance for the same amount. So if we're looking at someone with a sexual addiction who maybe is compulsively masturbating, if they're achieving orgasm 4 or 5 times a day, the brain becomes saturated with those chemicals, and then if they go through a withdrawal from that dopamine. So there is evidence to support that this is a brain disease, just like any other addiction.
Wow, that's very interesting. Okay, that's good to know. Now, you had mentioned earlier when you were describing what sex addiction is, I think that you had mentioned it, whether it was real or not. Now, I know that the American Psychiatric Association, who publishes the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, which is the manual that we use in order to clinically diagnose somebody with a particular disorder, does not have sex addiction, or does not recognize sex addiction as a mental health disorder.
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet, right? It's not in there. You know, it's funny because we have the new version, and this is the first time, this is version 5, this is the first time where they have a behavioral addiction, which is gambling.
Yeah.
But they haven't included sex addiction as one, which I personally am surprised with.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about why that's not included yet?
Well, I'm not so sure as to why, as much as the process with this new DSM-5 is that, you know, there was submitted proposals for new diagnoses and new clinical issues that we might need some more information on how to diagnose in order to better treat. And one of the recommended things was hypersexuality disorder, I believe.
Hypersexual disorder.
So that was submitted as a possibility, but then was rejected by the APA due to lack of clinical research is their reasoning. I think that if they would have given it another year, 2 or 5 years, there would have been plenty of research to support the diagnosis, especially with what I see going on in our community with ITAP and with the researchers that are involved with this in other CSATs, that there is so much new research coming out that there is a clinical ability to diagnose that sexual addiction, similar to gambling addiction or other behavioral addictions. There's just still building a body of research to support that.
Well, that's good. That's interesting because I am still surprised that it's not included and surprised that there's not enough research out there. I mean, this is nothing new.
Nope.
I think that in our society, we've been talking about sex addiction for such a long time. And it's not a new concept or idea.
Yeah.
But clinically, research-wise, we just don't have enough information that we would be able to, according to the APA, go in and diagnose somebody with a sex addiction. Okay, very interesting. So let's talk about what causes somebody to have a sexual addiction.
So with sexual addiction, they started to look at the different causes. And a lot of times, so we keep talking about the idea of like intimacy disorder. And when we're looking at the progression of sex addiction or the causes behind it, you know, a lot of times the discussion of attachment comes up, especially for clinicians, you know, like, so if I didn't know how to have the right amount of intimacy with my parents, I was either, you know, some emotional incest in my family or this really disconnected family system, I might not know how to soothe or process or cope with what I'm feeling as a small child. And so when we're looking at kids and attachment, you know, if we're looking at self-soothing, you know, I'm most likely to attach to food or sex as a kid. Those are the things that I have access to. With masturbation and now we see the problem with like younger and younger people having access to pornography. So then with that self-soothing, it starts to ingrain a pattern of behaviors where I use sex in order to mask or soothe my dysregulated affect, which is a very clinical term, right? But Alex Katakis, who's a researcher in our field, just released a book all about this, that it's a dysregulation of our emotional affect. And by using sex to regulate our feelings, we begin to this addictive cycle that then plays out. So that's one of the causes that we see. Another could be severe trauma or sexual abuse. Sometimes people develop any kind of addiction after experiencing a trauma in their adult life and kind of finding that way to numb out and end up in this habitual or compulsive behavior. Another cause could also be so I talked about trauma attachment, and it could just be the pure biological addiction model. You know, there's evidence to support that some people are just more addictive than others, and any substance that you put around them, they're going to misuse due to, I think Gabor Mate talks about having less dopamine receptors in our brains as addicts. And so anything that can heighten that dopamine response, we become addicted to. So there's a couple different causes. One of the things with addiction is that you never really know the exact cause. But with sex addiction, we know it's definitely has this relational component as well as a possible biological, environmental, or trauma-based component.
So with, I mean, if somebody is experiencing or has experienced sexual trauma, abuse, is that a guaranteed precursor to developing sexual addiction? I mean, you did mention, you know, going using food as well, but is it having that experience, is it a guaranteed pathway to sexual addiction?
Not at all. Not at all. I think all of us cope with things differently. But if we're looking at someone who is presenting, or if I'm looking at a client who's coming in and saying, I think I have a problem sexually, I think I might have a sex addiction, and I hear that there's sexual abuse in their history, I'm just going to like note that this could be part of the pattern that caused their acting out behavior. Whereas if I have another client who tells me that they are sexually abused, but they're not having these sexual addiction behavior patterns, I'm not going to assume that they are sex addicts. So it's that cause and effect, you know.
Right. But it's something that you use as the clinician as a, okay, I'm going to go back to this or keep this in the back of my mind as a possibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, what about relationships in which there is an over attachment, and you know, because there are some families in which there's an over identification with each other.
Yeah.
Has that been seen as possibly, you know, a cause to sexual addiction?
Yeah, actually, there's a great book called Silently Seduced, and it's by Ken Adams, and he talks about how it's his book specifically talks about mother enmeshed men, but this happens in any family system where there's over enmeshment or diffuse, like not if there's not good boundaries around sexuality between the parents and the children, or there's emotional fusion in the family, that can actually create sex addiction as well. So it's that I don't have containment around my sexual energy. I don't know how to contain or properly place my sexual energy because of this boundary system in my family. And I end up using the sex as an addictive way to escape that discomfort. So we as children are so sensitive to all that attachment stuff. So if mom and dad aren't there enough, I'm probably going to feel anxious. If mom and dad are too much in my space, I might feel anxious. It's just like now, if I got too much in your space bubble, you'd be like, oh, get away
right, from me.
Exactly. You know, and addiction's a really good way to say, please get away from me and protect and keep safe, keep people distant.
Yeah. Well, so far we've talked about relationship systemic experiences, but you mentioned also the hypersexuality and just people who are just born with a depletion of dopamine, you know, for example. But biologically, biologically there's a possibility that somebody is born with that predisposition for sexual addiction, because they their brain or the body requires that extra stimulation, whereas regular quote unquote, and I don't know how to define this, but would be normal.
Yeah,
exactly. What is normal? But normal sexual experiences would not be enough.
Yeah.
Now, could it be possible that a person who has that genetic predisposition to it, but have a positive systemic experience, still develop sexual addiction?
It's very possible, just depending on exposure. And then we go back to that addiction model versus the attachment model. If there is proper attachment, then it's more likely a purely addictions model for that client.
But,
even with the proper care and the proper environment, if I get exposed to pornographic material or high-risk sexual behavior, I start to experience, you know, those same addictive behaviors, even though I had this ideal systemic issue.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what are the different ways that sexual addiction can be expressed?
Oh, man. So there's actually, Pat Carnes talks about the 10 types of sexual addiction, right? So there's actually 10 different areas where we see sexual addiction manifest.
Really? I'm just thinking of three. That's it. But 10. Wow. I'd like to know what those 10 are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we have fantasy sex. There's voyeuristic sex, exhibitionistic sex, seductive role sex, pain exchange sex. You might have to excuse me while I remember.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those five. Okay, because that's a lot to take in right there.
Yes.
But the first one is fantasy. So what does that mean? I mean, it's just somebody who has...
Yeah, so this goes back to the what is sex addiction in the beginning, and how it can be so individually different, that if I'm working with someone who is a fantasy sex addict, they may have never physically acted out with anyone.
Right.
Right. So the entire addiction is solely going on in their head. And what that means is that I spend a lot of time obsessing or thinking about or visualizing sexual experiences. Fantasy sex can also usually correlates with high porn use and a lot of isolation. So, it isolates in my own fantasy world with this sexual behavior. But what can happen is if I try to be in a relationship with someone, I'm so stuck in that fantasy addiction.
It's never as good.
It's never as good.
Those experiences are never as good as it is in my head.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Or what I see in porn.
Yeah. And I mean, most of the sex addicts that I work with, that would be one of the first areas that this addiction showed up was fantasy.
Okay.
You know, that, seeing an image that was so striking or so seductive and alluring that it triggered that, like, I feel better when I imagine that. And so that starts off that fantasy sex.
Wow. Okay. You also mentioned the, did you mention bondage?
Not quite bondage.
Well, what is it? Yeah.
So I mentioned pain exchange.
Oh,
sex.
Pain exchange.
Yes,
yes, because I'm going there because we just recently interviewed two members of the BDSM community, Master Cecil and his partner Darcy, who are owners of the woodshed. Yeah. So we talked about kinky sex and just that whole culture.
Yeah.
But tell me about the pain exchange sex that is problematic.
Yeah. So when we're talking about BDSM, which I'm not going to go too much into because he just had a show on it, BDSM is very different than pain exchange sex. Pain exchange is usually what we would call trauma repetition based. So if I've had a painful sexual abuse history, I then start to recreate that same pain, humiliation. There can be domination and submission, but it's in much more of a violent or self-harm type of way. So this, with pain exchange, there's usually injury that goes past the point of, you know, red.
Right, what is safe.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So pain exchange is very high risk. You know, it can be very, very dangerous. We've had, in the news, we've talked about celebrities at the beginning of this a little bit. Like when we hear about a celebrity who passes away due to autoerotic asphyxiation, that is where it starts to cross the line where pain exchange sex has become really dangerous. So if the only way that I can achieve my ideal orgasm is by hanging myself from the door.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a really high risk behavior. So pain exchange crosses a line that BDSM in a healthy system doesn't.
Wow. That's because when we talked to Master Cecil and Darcy, it was strictly along the lines of what is safe.
Yeah.
It was more of a mind experience than it is a physical one. But here you're talking about how it goes beyond the red. It's beyond the safe zone where that person needs to recreate that abuse history in the present.
And what can happen is that same tolerance, you know, so I start to have higher tolerance for the amount of painful situations that I'm putting myself in, and I can lead myself into more dangerous situations. So, we were talking earlier about movies and a movie that
I know what you're going to mention. Yeah,
I am. I'm going to mention. So Nymphomaniac 1 and 2 was one that came out
by Lars von Trier.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Okay.
And, he depicts a lot of the pain exchange, sex that can happen where it's so important for the person to achieve a higher and higher level of pain in order to feel sexual that they start to injure themselves in ways that can be really scary, really damaging.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about one other manifestation.
We also talked about seductive role sex.
Ooh, yeah, yes, okay.
That's another one of the 10 types. And with seductive role sex, that is that, you think of that like Rico Suave.
Well, that's me. What are you talking about?
Yes, of course. But that's the person who, it's about the conquest. It's about the chase. There's another type. One of the other 10 types is anonymous sex. So a lot of times seductive role sex and anonymous sex may play a part together. But for some people, it's solely about the chase. You know, and it's about seducing people and magnetizing them using your sexuality. And it's about the conquest. Once the person is interested sexually, I'm on to the next, you know, seductive partner. So a lot of times with that, that kind of corresponds to with like relational addiction or sex, or what we also call sex and love addiction. So that seductive role, playing out these fantasies in action by seducing people. And then once the seduction's done, just tossing them to the side.
Right.
And that can be, that's where you start to see like people or clients who identify as addicts, they'll tell their stories about like leaving a trail of people behind them that they wounded, you know, because usually the prey in that seductive role pattern,
they don't know it. They don't expect it.
No. Yeah.
They feel that there is a connection there, that they are interested in.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
But then next thing they know, once they have that encounter, there's no phone call. And they're on to the next person because the thrill is gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And that tolerance for I need more and more in order to achieve the same result. I need to seduce more and more people, or I need to have multiple seductive partners going on at the same time.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was able to go online real quick, and I know I'm asking you to recall all this information, 10 of them, but I was able to go online and look up the information. And so I'm just going to go down the list again.
It's
fantasy sex, seductive role sex, which we talked about already, anonymous sex, paying for sex, trading sex, voyeuristic sex, exhibitionist sex, intrusive sex, pain exchange, and exploitative sex.
Yeah.
Okay. I actually want to hear or talk a little bit about paying for sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more about what that is?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So paying for sex is when I become part of my sexual acting out is attached to paying someone for a sexual experience. So the idea of having control over being able to pay someone, it's a bartered exchange, money for sex. This is where the intimacy disorder is like, you can really see some of the intricacies, because someone who's in seductive role sex, it's about the getting all that new relational mojo, you know, and that seduction and trying to use someone in order to fill up this insecurity. The person who's going to have the sex addiction and more of that paying for sex role doesn't want anything to do with the seduction. I don't want to have to talk to you. I don't want to know anything. I don't want to seduce. I want to have a clear cut exchange. So paying for sex, the most common way that we might see that is like massage parlors, you know, which are really just brothels, and paying for that to be stimulated after a massage, or hiring prostitutes, picking up street prostitution or strip clubs is also where pay for sex will come out. And so for some people, and I'm going to be gender biased here for a moment.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
This happens for women as well, but this is a category that is predominantly male.
Yeah.
And there's so much of a connection between that power and money, power and paying, and that there's no emotional connection to the person because we just paid for a service.
Right.
And a lot of times, like, it helps. So one of the things that we talk about in addiction recovery is our denial system, right? If I'm paying for sex, I get to deny that it's really a problem because it's this clear-cut transaction and I can compartmentalize it and then pretend like it didn't happen. It's not cheating because I wasn't emotionally connected to the person.
Right.
I paid for it and it was done.
Yeah,
so it can become really complex and difficult.
Yeah, I can see how it is complex, because the first thing that I thought about when you talked about massage parlors and paying for sex, and you know, was I immediately went to that gender differences and how for some men in our society, it's almost like a rite of passage. You know, you reach a certain age, you go out with your buddies, you go to sex clubs or strip bars, and you know, you pay for sexual experiences, and it's a male bonding experience.
Yeah.
So at what point does it become, I mean, is that problem? Is that sex addiction, or is it just a transaction?
That's a great question, because one of the things about us as humans is there's a wide range of like healthy sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as it's two consenting people, you're going to an establishment where the girls are by choice there. It's not sex trafficking. It's not, there's not that going on. It's two consenting adults paying for a service. There's nothing innately wrong with going to a strip club. You know, I mean, that's my personal view. That's what I would tell a client. But when it gets to that line,
how do we define that?
And what I tell some of my clients who come in is like, if your wife thinks it's a problem and you're still doing it, it's a problem for you.
Okay.
You know, and so that person might not consider themselves, if they weren't in a relationship, maybe they wouldn't consider themselves a sex addict. I don't know. But if it's causing problems, it might be a problem. Mm-hmm. With strip clubs, though, there's a lot of, and I think this goes back to our conversation about the DSM as well, but our society moralizes sexuality, and sex addiction is not a moral issue. You know, but we moralize it. So if that man was a good man, you know, he wouldn't be at the strip club every Saturday night. And that's not true. You know, there's a powerlessness that happens in addiction where I convince myself that I have to do this in order to be okay. It's a very defeating and trapped place to be. For the average male going for a male bonding experience that's not causing external problems, he's able to be honest with his partner. You know, I'm going out with the guys. Maybe she's like, please don't tell me where you go. Mm-hmm, but as long as there's honesty and integrity in your romantic relationship or your personal relationships, you're not spending money you don't have, you know, like you're within a healthy boundary system. There's nothing wrong with doing that. The person who goes outside of their boundaries, though, or lies to their partner about that, or is going, staying later than his friends, or you start to see this increased, that preoccupation, loss of control. I'm going more and more, more often, or I'm spending more than I wanted to spend. That's when it starts to go into, that's not a moral issue. That is an addiction. It's not that the person's a bad person.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that because it seems like it's something as that there's an element of what's negotiated in a relationship if that person is in a relationship because if they are partnered and their partner says, I'm okay, you can go out and enjoy, go out with your friends and I know you're going to do what you're going to do and everything, but come home tonight and, you know, and in that intimate relationship, it is negotiated and it's okay. It's not problematic.
Yes.
Okay. But it's when the partner says, absolutely not. I don't want you to do that. That is a violation of our relationship, but they still go out and do it. Then that's problematic. Yes. And it's, you know, two same behaviors, but with different rules in the relationship. That is what depicts a problematic experience. Okay. Yeah. I like that. Okay. Yeah. So then how do you work with somebody who is struggling with a sex addiction?
Yeah. So if someone comes into me and says, you know, I think I might have a sex addiction, or usually what happens is they come in and say, my partner thinks I have a problem, but I'm totally fine. Yeah.
but that's the case for many other types of addictions.
It is. And many other types of mental health issues, you know, everyone else, we're the last ones to know.
We are.
So when a client comes in, what I do is I usually refer them to a website called recoveryzone.com or sexhelp.com. And there's a short screening test called the SAST, which is the sexual addiction screening test. And you enter in your gender information, your orientation, and then you answer the set of questions. And it kind of gives you a little guideline for like, are you a card carrying member of the sex addict community, or is your behavior more along the lines of, you know, just a sexual dysfunction, but not addiction. Or you're not a sex addict at all. So it's a nice screening test because it helps me know what the client's really presenting. It helps the client see what's really going on. And it takes kind of the guesswork out because we've gone on and on about how individualized sex addiction is. This kind of breaks it down into clear cut. If you're over this number, let's explore this some more.
Right.
So that's the first step.
Tool for you as a clinician, you have the client who may be in denial, who may say, no, I don't think I have a problem.
Yeah. But you're it a helps 12.
Raise, well, you're a 12 on the scale, but it raises awareness. Yeah. It, you know, lets that person basically be exposed to something that they may not have known about themselves or have been in denial, then you can work with that in therapy.
Yes.
And do you use that assessment and
I
go
do.
Through the various answers and help them to have a richer understanding?
Yeah. And after we do that initial screening, because I also want to touch on that, sometimes people come in saying, like, I think I have a sex addiction because of what their community might tell them, their spiritual communities or their families or, you know, or they're struggling with their orientation. And there's just different stuff going on. And they've heard the word sex addiction and are afraid, oh, this is sex addiction. And that screening test can kind of weed out when it's like, no, that's not sex.
That's a really good point. I can see how someone may receive a message because they may be struggling with their sexual identity and they may not be aware of it, but they're, you know, they're exploring.
Or even I've watched pornography.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's against my spiritual beliefs.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then the message they receive is you are bad. You have a sex problem. And so how do you work with somebody who comes in and says, hey, okay, I masturbate once a week. I'm a bad person. I have sex addiction.
Well, I think where I would go there is we would go through those diagnostic criteria.
Yeah.
If they don't meet them, okay, then let's talk about what the real problem is that you feel out of integrity with your spirituality.
Okay. So then the assessment is still helpful because it can help the person realize that clinically, they don't meet the requirement for a sex addiction. Now let's talk about more about your own personal beliefs and your own values. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's take the clinical aspect out and look at you and your own ideas.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So then with the person who does identify as a sex addict, I would then have them do, you know, for me, how I work and how we work at New Leaf Center is we like to have like a full detailed evaluation of the client up front. It allows us to better assess what's going on and formulate better treatment and care for our clients. So we would do a 2-hour, sometimes 3-hour evaluation. We would then do more in-depth testing through resources at ITAP. I use something called the SDI, which is the Sexual Dependency Inventory, which is a collection of a couple different assessments all in one. And you can read more about that on recoveryzone.com. They have all the internal validity and all that stuff, all the details about it. But it's a really well done test, and that gives me more in-depth information. It looks at those 10 types of sexual acting out behavior. So I get a clear picture of what this client is really doing. It also gives me scales to show what they're thinking about doing or what the general pattern of their behavior is, so I can really zero in and treat them accurately because of that individual difference. So then after that initial intake phase, it would also then be, you know, dealing with the family. Is your partner hurt by this behavior? What type of support or crisis management do we need to do? Most of my clients do not come in like, hey, you know, I just woke up this Sunday and decided it was time to change. There's usually catastrophe going on in their lives. And so the first, what we call that first period is like that growth or that introductory period, crisis stabilization. So after that initial crisis period, which can be anywhere from the first 3 months to the first 6 months, really, for members who may have divorced or custody issues going on, because a lot of times we see that coincide, that their crisis stage may be the first year and a half, you know? So helping that client manage those, putting out those fires, basically. So after the crisis stage, there's that growth and repair. And then eventually the long-term goal is moving into maintenance or recovery. And the way that we go about it is I tell clients that it could take up to 3 to 5 years to really get into that maintained recovery. Our sexuality is so core to who we are, you know, that treatment is very in depth. But the good thing is that for the addict who follows through with this treatment protocol, and I use a set of tasks, a task model, as well as individual and group therapy, and also the use of support groups like 12-step support outside. If that client follows that treatment protocol, there's I mean, the people who are in recovery are in, and start to experience that intimacy and that recovery life that is like beyond their wildest dreams. So my sex addict clients are so inspiring to me because they end up having better relationships than the people who weren't sex addicts originally.
Right. Yeah.
Because they have such healthy boundaries and such awareness of their sexual behavior and such a commitment to being in loving, caring, supportive relationships. And there's an article that I read years ago about how the best person to be in a relationship with is a recovering sex addict. And I tend to agree from what I see of my clients in recovery.
Going through 3 years of therapy, learning how to be intimate with somebody, reconnect with themselves, reconnect with other people, has really developed a language for themselves and a way of being that is probably beyond the person who has not gone through that process.
Even people who aren't addicts, I don't think that even people who don't have sexual addiction don't really get taught about healthy sexuality either. There's still that confusion around sex and what recovery can offer a sex addict is also a new understanding of like healthy, energized sexual expression that they didn't have before.
Yeah.
So even in that, some of the complaints about sex addiction is that it's like anti-sex and that diagnosis is shaming sexually. And that's so not true from what I see. Like recovery in its fullest is also regaining all that healthy sexuality. Mm-hmm. So, if you have a healthy understanding of sexuality and intimacy and partner awareness and internal awareness, it's like, sounds like a good partner to me.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you talk about going into healthy relationships. And when we look at other types of addiction, substance addiction, it's a common form of practice that in somebody who's in recovery, if they're struggling with an addiction, that they would abstain from that substance. Mm-hmm. And there's a very popular saying that once an addict is always an addict. That's very debatable. I understand it really depends on the person. But that doesn't seem to be the case for sex addicts, where there is complete abstinence to any type of sexual experience. You are working with a person to gradually reconnect and to go into a more healthy sexual relationship.
Yeah. And there is what I usually ask clients to do in the beginning is like a little bit of a 90-day abstinence period. Mm-hmm. So even if the person comes in and they don't have a problem with, say, watching pornography, I still will ask them to abstain from pornography and masturbation and give themselves 90 days to just get really clear-headed.
Oh, that's reasonable. That's reasonable to expect. And it's completely different than having a lifelong abstinence.
Yes. Yeah. So then what becomes in recovery is I have abstinence from bottom line or unacceptable behaviors for me. Mm-hmm. A good example is that, like you brought up about the strip club, like it would be a bottom line for me to attend the strip club and lie to my partner about it. You know, that's no longer acceptable for me. If I did that, I would be in relapse. It becomes this very intricate, like what is relapse for each individual person and knowing exactly what that line is.
Got it.
Yeah. So there's no complete abstinence from sexuality, obviously. And your sexual addiction might not be my sexual addiction. So I tell this to my clients in recovery, I can't assume that someone else's recovery is not right or they're not doing it the right way because it's so individual. And I also want to touch base on that, like once an addict, always an addict type thing. I think that being a lifelong addict, it's not about never having sex again. Being a sex addict for the rest of your life, it's not about never having sex again. It's about knowing that at any point, if I'm not vigilant about taking care of myself and taking care of my boundaries in recovery, that I could relapse to a point that I will end up back in all of my addictive behaviors.
Right. So it's a day-by-day mindful way of living, being aware of your relationships, of your behaviors. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. You know, I like that it's you mentioned how long the treatment can be. It's 3 years, maybe more.
Yeah,
it is substantial. And it The reason why I like that is because it's not a quick fix.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it is very fortunate. I mean, well,
maybe unfortunately for my clients.
Well, it's unfortunate, you know, but
that want a quick fix.
Yeah, but you know, in mental health, because of our limitations with insurance companies, third-party insurance companies, or for financial reasons, there is a huge dependency on brief forms of therapy, yeah. which are not as effective, and we know this by research, not as effective as long-term forms of therapy. I mean, it didn't take... developing a sexual addiction didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen after over 3 days.
Nope.
This is a very long process, so it would be reasonable to... expect that it would be a long process to go through it and to fully heal, get to the point where it is manageable for you. So I like that. But how, you know, talking about financial difficulties, I mean, how difficult is it for someone to go through and dedicate their time? I mean, what's the recidivism rate?
No. Well, I mean, as far as financially, what's really neat about the recovery community is that there's so many resources that are low to no cost, as far as like 12-step support groups such as SAA or SLAA.
What are they?
SAA is Sex Addicts Anonymous.
Yes.
There's also another fellowship called SA, which is Sexaholics Anonymous. And then there's SLAA, which is Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And those are all free support groups. They are independently run. They are fully self-supporting. I have no affiliation with them, but it's a place where people can go and just have peers to mm-hmm. discuss, mm-hmm. like, here's what I'm going through. And I mean, any addiction, but especially sex addiction is so fueled by shame that to go and have a community that you can be part of that understands what process you're in is so important. So there's that free resource. And then in combination, individual and group resources. Group therapy is always a little bit cheaper than individual therapy, you know? So if you are looking at treating a sex addiction, you've found a CSAT therapist and you're concerned about financial costs, ask about the possibility for group therapy. I think it's very important to do individual therapy as well, but that's always a nice little, not every person would know that. Let me rewind a little bit. If you do think that you're having a problem with sex addiction, then a good way to go about finding resources is through that Recovery Zone website. They have a list of CSAT therapists on the website, so that way you can find if there's someone in your area, and also call and ask. You know, hey, do you offer any group rates? Do you offer reduced rate individual? Do you offer, you know, any kind of counseling for my partners? You know, do you guys offer couples counseling? Because as you go through your recovery, you want to know that you're somewhere where you have all the resources that you need in order to get the best result. A lot of times we talk about substance abuse or substance dependency and substance addiction as like a life or death matter. I mean, we see it all the time, people dying from overdose. But sex addiction is just as much life and death, I think. There's very high rates of suicide for untreated sex addicts because of that shame and fear about asking for help. So ask for help sooner, sooner rather than later. Okay. If you think that there is a problem, ask for help. And you can minimize some of the very negative consequences that we see, such as suicide or divorce or even legal issue as a result of sex addiction.
And can you repeat that website one more time for our listeners?
Yes, it's recoveryzone.com.
Okay, good. Now, I know that we are coming to an end, but I do have a couple of questions that I want to ask, and I think that if I don't ask them, that I would regret it.
Yes.
Okay, but we are coming to an end, okay? Yeah. So let's see how quickly, because this is a very big philosophical discussion.
Yeah,
okay?
We'll do rapid-fire questions.
Rapid-fire. Okay, because you mentioned a couple of things that was listed on that assessment that you use to help identify with your client's sexual addictions, but the assessment asks for gender.
Mm-hmm.
And also for orientation.
Yes.
So why is that important for the assessment? I mean, what difference does it make whether they're male or female as far as how they answer the questions?
Yeah, so with our testing, what we found is that some categories are statistically higher for men than for female, or males than females. So if I'm answering from the female perspective, if I know that on my test, I know that I can expect some of these, it's hard because I don't have an image, but some of these levels to be elevated due to my gender. If I'm a male taking the test and I see the results, these are the categories that we expect to see higher due to gender. So there are gender differences, like we talked about. Paying for sex is more of a male-dominated category, where relational addiction is really more commonly female. So just even biologically or like neurologically, women and men are wired in some differences, and these are very general statements that are not always true. But for the majority of the time, what we see is that men are a little bit less relational than women, and that so women's addiction manifests more in that relational atmosphere. That's not to say that men aren't relationship addicts, but we see that higher with women. So that's one of the gender differences. Another difference that we see is as far as some of the pain exchange, that's also a more female dominated category. More women engage in pain exchange sex than men. Another gender difference is just the socialization of men and women. You know, it's much, there's kind of a cultural okayness with men's sexuality, you know, like, oh, it's expected for guys to want sex. So when a female is a sex addict, there's that like, oh, well, whereas a guy might be a stud, a female might be a slut, you know?
Right.
And that's a hard word to even say, but it is so, so demeaning towards women with sexuality that for a female to have sex addiction, it's very, very shameful. And there's a lot of secretive behaviors that go on with that. Or we also see women enter into the sex working as a way to act out on their sexual addiction and it be more culturally or socially acceptable. So again, not every sex worker is a sex addict. That means, but we do see our female sex addicts go towards that realm, or that they express more as love addicts.
Okay. Wow. And then what about sexual orientation? Is there a difference between non-gay and gay individuals? Yes.
So if there was like very little research on sex addiction up to this point, less. There's even less on this. But there is some interesting. So male sex addicts who identify as bisexual or gay and are in a relationship with another male, but this goes back to the relational stuff, you know, there's less relational attachment for men. And sex is not as emotional for men as it is for women. And so there's a little bit of a cultural influence in gay male culture where it's like, if you want to have sex with another man and we are in agreement with it, then that's okay. Mm. And you don't see that in heterosexual relationships. So there's that dynamic that sex addiction can be less identified because of some of the norms in male sexual culture. But the same addiction, progression, loss of control can still happen for gay men. With lesbians, there's even less research than for gay males.
Wow. Yeah.
And we see, as far as like the statistics go, we see less lesbians entering into treatment than any other group entering into treatment. So there's some speculation as to why that is. Some of it is that because of how relational women are, when you put two women together, they're not likely to engage. I don't know that that's necessarily true, though.
Oh, yeah, right. Because there's not enough research out there, but we're hypothesizing here. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
There's also the idea that it's more the relational addiction that might be showing up for the lesbian population, or that their sex addiction is manifested in ways that, like through pornography or seductive role, having emotional affairs is another like kind of social term that we use for that behavior. But we're not exactly sure what's going on in our lesbian community with sex addiction.
Oh, we need more research.
I know.
You need to get on that faith. Okay?
I know. I've already written a thesis or a hypothesis about it all.
Oh, awesome. Well, Faith, thank you so much for being on the show. This brings us to the end, unfortunately, but we'd love to have you come back and say a little bit more, because it's obviously a very complex situation or a very complex topic. So Again, thank you for being on the show, and
thank you for having me.
Yes, yeah, yes, absolutely.
You are listening to
WPRK
91.5 FM.
The best.
The best.
The best in basement radio.
WPRK.
WPRK.
Yes, it's recording. Okay.